Iku Iluna, please rise. Ahea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuleana imua okea aha. Ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o kumoku aina o Hawaii. E nai mai, e maliu mai, I lohi ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Let's call the case. Right, good morning, aloha everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary YouTube channel. And I'll just say to all the attorneys who are arguing today, you can take your mask off when you approach it or at the podium if you wish. Ms. Obrey, you have 22 minutes, 8 minutes reserved for rebuttal, so we'll give you a warning 22 minutes in. Mr. Kapowski and Mr. Day, 15 minutes each, will give you a warning each of you at the end of your allotted time. Are you ready to proceed? Please proceed.
Belina me ke aloha, mahalo, Chief Justice Rectum Wald and Associate Justices. Article 12, Section 7 places the burden on the state to preserve and protect Native Hawaiian rights. Now, this court has also repeatedly recognized that state agencies must show that they fulfilled their duties and justify actions that could affect these cultural and religious practices. The state's affirmative duty does not disappear in administrative rule challenges. Therefore, when defending rules, a state agency must carry that same burden that it has when it considers the approval of development and construction and show that it acted to preserve and protect traditional and customary practices. So today I would like to make two main points related to the reserved question. And the first is that the state has the burden of proof to show that it acted to protect traditional and customary practices. And second, that state agencies must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the rules do not unreasonably regulate these practices. So as to that first part of the question, does the burden shift? Yes, and that is because the state always bears the burden to show that it adequately considered Native Hawaiian traditional and customary practices whenever it acts. It is very well settled that Article 12, Section 7 imposes an affirmative duty to preserve and protect these rights. And this kuleana is made clear by the provision's plain language, as well as kapa'akai. It was reaffirmed in that case by this court as well. This affirmative duty includes both the due consideration of traditional and customary practices by state agencies, as well as the substantive protection of these practices subject to the state's ability to reasonably regulate them. Now, this court has also placed the burden on state agencies to demonstrate that they have fulfilled their duty to Native Hawaiians via written findings and conclusions. So, for example, in the Kapa'akai case, this court put the burden on the state to follow a framework implementing Article 12, Section 7, requiring findings that identify and consider Native Hawaiian rights.
Counsel, your argument right now raises the question that I have, and that is, in a contested case hearing, the agency clearly has to provide findings of fact, conclusions of law. Now, the Attorney General argues that rules are like laws. It's like legislation. It's like quasi-legislation. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm wondering how you would propose that the agency would then prove beyond a reasonable doubt that their regulations did not unreasonably infringe on Native Hawaiian traditional and customary rights. How would they do that?
So the standard that we were looking to in order to get to that place, we know that the state has the burden given this affirmative duty under the Constitution. So once a plaintiff makes an assertion that Native Hawaiian rights are impacted by a rule, which is like kapa'akai because there were these assertions made, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt about that the rules do not unreasonably regulate them. And I think we can look to Kapa'akai for that reasonableness. The state
right,
has
but my question is a practical question. Mm-hmm. How does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Because in a contested case hearing, it is findings of fact, conclusions of law. Are you saying that findings of fact, conclusions of law have to be then be made as to how it was done and whether the regulations are reasonable, et cetera?
Right. Yeah. If we're being consistent in how we apply Kapa'akai, that same requirement should apply during rulemaking in terms of making findings. We have to remember that.
But then if rules are like legislation, this, whatever rule that we come up, and if we follow the proposal, it would also apply to the legislature. So I'm wondering, are we then going to require legislators to prepare findings of fact, conclusions of law as to compliance with Article 12, Section 7? I'm trying to wrap my head around what is it that you're actually proposing?
Well, I would agree that technically Kapa'akai, if this burden applies to the state in general, technically that obligation is on the legislature as well. In terms of the scope of this question, we are talking about administrative agencies. The legislature has given these agencies the authority to promulgate rules because they have specific areas of expertise. And so they're promulgating these rules because they're able to maybe have a better handle on what impacts may occur and how best to manage, whether it be the UH's rules or whatever entity it may be. So I would push that, yes, this obligation doesn't go away in any context. It should be there. But in terms of our role today or your role today in thinking about this, we're talking about the administrative context. And Mm-hmm. Well, I would push back a little in terms of there being no evidence and no record. There's when you go through the rulemaking process in Chapter 91, there's opportunity to get views from the public. People have a chance to give testimony. I think under Kapa'akai, agencies have this duty to investigate, and it is their affirmative duty to do so. So I think if we're limiting ourselves by this legislative construct that is Chapter 91, which is, very important when we're talking about the differences, there's a reason why rulemaking is separate from quasi-judicial proceedings. But in the context of protecting these practices under this provision, I think it's a distinction without a difference because, hang on, I've lost my thought there. But all that to say that this duty just has to follow the agency wherever it goes. And so a decision in promulgating a rule can be just as powerful as a decision approving a permit. That's a valid question, and because that's not within the scope of this question per se, I haven't given enough thought, honestly, to the legislative side of things. But again, the state's affirmative duty, whether it be the legislature or an agency, their job is to make this investigation, identify practices, determine impacts of an action on practices, and figure out the best way to mitigate those impacts.
So, I mean, your reply to the agency. indicated that the agency may also be required to issue a concise statement of principal reasons for and against the determination requested by an interested person. Is that the kind of statement that you expect would be issued, where the agency in promulgating the rule would have some kind of associated statement explaining how it went about identifying potential Native Hawaiian practices that were implicated and what the impacts would be and what it did to Native?
Yeah, correct. I would say that, I mean, that's at minimum, that's what they should be doing. And that, as you pointed out, Chief Justice, that's already in Chapter 91, that there is this kind of a written statement should be at the ready if the public requests it. So it's not too far off from what we're asking. And one thing I wanted to point out as well, if I may, the state already requires this for small businesses. HRS 201M, when promulgating rules that may affect small businesses, they're supposed to be identifying potential impacts to small business. And there's an obligation to write a robust report and to try to mitigate impacts as well. So if, sure.
While you're on this subject about the procedures that was used for small business, I wanted to get clear your position on what exactly happened when these rules were passed. Is it your position that Article 12, Section 7 was ignored when the rules were passed? Or are you suggesting that in challenging the rules after they were passed, there has to be a burden placed on the state, a burden, I'm interested in how you define the burden, but at least the initial burden is on the party challenging the rule to raise the issue. But after that, your suggestion is there's a burden on the state to show that there has been sufficient recognition of mm-hmm. Native Hawaiian customary practices. So getting back to the question, are you suggesting that Article 12, Section 7 was completely ignored when the rules were passed?
In terms of the rules in the underlying case, which
the rules that you're challenging.
Yes, yeah. The rules that we're challenging. I would say that it was ignored in terms of how in the promulgation of the rules that are being challenged.
So you're questioning both the failure to consider it at all, as well as the
correct
that's particular the burden that was being borne in the event that the Article 12, Section 7 was considered. You're suggesting that the burden has to be borne by the state.
Correct. Although the first part of your question, I think, is not necessarily under the scope of this question. We're talking about the burden to the challenge the administrative rules, but I would say that is definitely part of the equation and how we would look at moving forward in the analysis.
And how do you define the burden that is assumed by the state when it, under your view, is in the position to show that it did recognize sufficiently Native Hawaiian custom and practices are under Article 12, Section 7?
So again, that is where we would suggest looking to Kapa'akai. So on its face, Kapa'akai there's a procedural element to it, and we recognize that. But in the context of a challenge to administrative rules, when we look at the reasonability of rules, there's a little bit of a balancing, and we're just sort of looking to the idea that Kapa'akai puts forward in terms of the state being able to show in court that it did identify the practices that could be affected by its rules. It considered the extent to which its rules would impact them and the feasible ways maybe the rules could be drafted or they could rethink the policy so that these practices are not regulated out of existence.
Chief Justice, I gotta check your mic real quick.
Testing, testing. You need us to take a recess while you work on this? Or okay.
Okay, the court will take a brief recess. Thank you. All right. Thank you to our council and our viewers and guests here in Ali'i Ulani Hale for your patience. We're back up and running. Ms. Obrey, I was going to ask, without some statement of reasons or some explanation, how would anybody be able to understand how the state or whether the state took these interests into account, assessed the impact, and adopted a feasible approach to addressing them?
Yeah, that's precisely what, you know, why I would advocate for the fact that findings are necessary, both at the agency rulemaking, at the agency rulemaking level, and why that translates into the courtroom, because it is the state who would be in the best position to understand, you know, what it is it's trying to accomplish. A Native Hawaiian practitioner, I mean, if I could use as a hypothetical the underlying facts here, we have administrative rules with pages and pages of prohibitions on activities on public ceded lands that restrict practices that the university knows exist on Mauna Kea, but those were enacted anyway. And now it falls on a family who carry this kuleana to protect the place and to protect those cultural activities that exist there. And they have to bear the burden, you know, through discovery and trial to prove that the state did not do something. And that is why findings are so important. And I think this court even said that in the recent Carmichael case, with respect to the BLNR needing to back up its decision-making with findings, because that is the only way that someone in the community would know, you know, what the state considered. That is the only way a court would know, you know, if we had to go to court for any kind of
enforcement. So in this case, the university took sort of a broad approach, I guess is how they say they have a provision that broadly protects Native Hawaiian rights and references Article 12, Section 7. And that's one approach. But the concern I understand your clients are articulating is they don't know what that means with regard to if they can take basalt from the summit. They don't know what that means if they try to go to a pu'u where they've traditionally gone. They don't know exactly what that means if they want to go up at night. Although the provisions say that I guess there's a prohibition on going up at night, but I guess they would in their mind have to balance whether they have a tradition, they have a constitutional right to go up at night as opposed to this broad prohibition on nighttime activities. And so your point, as I understand it, is that that process of coming to that outcome needs to be explained in the record. Is that what you're advocating for?
Yes, correct. I mean, and especially if we're talking about those rules where we see these wholesale exemptions from the whole chapter for university employees, for contract workers. And so even more so, yes, we need a better understanding.
Is that in there now? I mean, does a record contain an explanation of why the university went this particular approach without prejudging whether it's a valid approach or not?
I think there is some discussion. Well, it would be in the briefing is where I would really see the state's thought process, the university's thought process, but there is a, you know, there's a record of various testimony and letters and things that were received. I mean, that's part of the rulemaking process, as you know, but in terms of whether someone like the Flores case Ohana would know exactly what the state did or didn't consider, that's something that, you know, we can learn for the first time from these briefs, from bringing this case.
Would this process have to take place every time there's a rulemaking that might implicate Native Hawaiian rights? I'm trying to understand from the state, because the process you're describing takes place when the rule is promulgated, that's not a post hoc rationalization. So is this, how would the agency know that they would just always have to at least begin an inquiry as to whether there are Native Hawaiian interests at stake? Is that correct?
I think that's what the Constitution says and what Kapa'akai says, that there's this obligation to investigate and there's an obligation to identify. And if there's nothing found, then perhaps that's could be the end of it. And, you know, maybe they're okay, but there is this affirmative obligation and that needs to occur.
What if no one comes forward and offers comments? What does the agency do in that situation? I know you had a footnote in your brief that said there wouldn't be a waiver, but, you know, what is the agency's obligation if they put forth a rule, ask for comment, nobody comments? Do they have to retain an expert, a cultural expert? They don't have any input. What do they do at that point to determine whether there might be an impact on traditional and customary practices?
If they are taking on this affirmative duty, I would assume that before the rules even promulgated and drafts come out, there's already an inquiry being made. There's already research being done, because that is the affirmative obligation of the agency. Someone like, for example, the Board of Land and Natural Resources, they're experts in, you know, public land. And so I would assume, you know, with Ahamoku, and I know I'm kind of going a little bit off of in a tangent, but they know where to look, I would assume. And that's the whole purpose of these agencies that have this very specific area of expertise. And so, yeah, their affirmative obligation is to go look for it.
But I think you agree that the initial burden to raise the issue lies with the challenger of the rule.
Yes, in the context of administrative rulemaking challenge in court, there needs to at least be an assertion. And I guess that's true at the administrative agency as well, that Kapa'akai said that it's not a burden of proof per se, it's that the practitioner would come forward, you know, that there might be assertion that there's a practice that could be impacted. So if we want to call that an initial prima facie burden, I mean, I think that's fine, but really it's a mere assertion is enough.
The Flores case, Ohana would come forward and say, we traditionally go to the on the mauna at night, and we sometimes take basalt, or we want to create a structure when we're there. And having said that and been able to establish those are traditional and customary practices, then what happens? What now we're at court, then what happens at that point? The agency points to the document that you said should have been created earlier. Is that, or can the agency then come together and say, well, these are our reasons? Which of those two versions of the world is it that you're advocating for?
It could be both. If they have done their duty below in terms of the, you know, doing the findings as part of the rulemaking process, that document is something that would definitely help them meet their burden a lot more easily. But I would imagine there's more reasoning that would need to go into it, explanation of the rule on its face and how it does or doesn't accomplish what they intended it to accomplish in light of the practices that may be impacted. So
I'm trying to figure out why this could not be analyzed under the traditional vagueness challenges to a law or a rule. And it appears to me that when constitutional rights are implicated, it doesn't even have to be a practitioner. If it's anyone can assert this. Whether the law or rules are so vague to prohibit constitutionally protected conduct. And I'm wondering, you know, even if they came up with, they had a findings or a document, mm-hmm. A court could still find it to be an unreasonable restriction, and that it wasn't, they didn't go through the proper analysis. So that's why I'm wondering why we couldn't analyze this under the traditional vagueness challenges to a law or a rule. Why would that not work under these circumstances?
When we talk about, well, first, I think, and this may touch on your previous question as well. So when we know that there are fundamental rights at stake, we've seen this in other instances. The burden is always on the government or the state to prove that, you know, its rule or its law is reasonable in light of this other right that's at play. And, you know, we've seen that. And we know that Native Hawaiian rights in Hawaii, if they're not fundamental, they are really close to being a fundamental right in our jurisprudence. And so, you know, I think that that's a good foundational way to look at things. I would agree as well with HRS 917. The fact that anyone can bring these types of actions just means that supports the idea that it need only be an assertion by a plaintiff. Because if any person can bring it, then, I mean, that person doesn't need to prove really anything. And now the burden goes to the government to say, no, we did do this, or maybe they didn't. And as a result, the way the rules are written does or does not meet, you know, constitutional muster. So, but I think we do have a model to look to in terms of how the courts have treated it in other fundamental rights cases, that this is, the burden is on the government always when there's a right like this at stake.
Let me ask you this, you know, we have a narrow reserve question here. Mm-hmm. And is there any case in any jurisdiction that shifts the burden of proof to the government to show that its own statute or rule is constitutional?
I mean, I would go back to my previous answer in terms of all the fundamental rights cases. When we talk about First Amendment, when we talk about equal protection, Second Amendment, and there's even, you know, not within a constitutional framework, but this court as well has shifted the burden away from a plaintiff when the plaintiff is forced to prove a negative. And those are like with product liability type cases, where how would a plaintiff know whether a third party substantially changed a product? So it's the defendant's job to make that first showing that there was some kind of a change. And so, I mean, I guess my point is that this burden shifting away from a plaintiff, or in particular here, a Native Hawaiian practitioner in the constitutional framework, it's not a new concept.
Are the cases you're referring to, and you say the First Amendment, you cited Berger, do those cases actually hold that the burden shifts to the government and that the government must prove the constitutionality beyond a reasonable doubt? Was that the holding in those cases?
I mean, that is the purpose for which we are looking at it in terms of the framework of how the court approaches it. I would have to, hang on, I could pull the specific language for you if that would be helpful.
It seems that most of those cases are looking at whether the statute or the rule was narrowly tailored. Isn't that a little different than the shifting of the burden?
Correct. That is fair. And that is why that's not the test. We're not citing to those cases for the purpose of what the analysis should be, but just the idea that when there is a fundamental right at stake, like a First Amendment right, like a Native Hawaiian practice under our constitution here in Hawaii, that the burden has to go to the government to show that its rules are reasonable, that this is a tool in this court's tool belt to address now, these kinds of rights.
How does Article 12, Section 7's other side, in other words, and I say other side meaning the state's right to regulate certain conduct, how does that balance work in this shifting? I mean, doesn't that play? I mean, when you talk about First Amendment, you're talking about an absolute First Amendment, right? Absolute protections. Mm-hmm. I see there being a balance and there having to be almost a fundamental case-dependent totality of the circumstances analysis. And when you're talking about a facial challenge, which is purely a question of law, I see that as being a difficult thing. I mean, how can you explain to me how it would work?
I mean, I would say the fact that the state has the right to reasonably regulate just really highlights the reason that these findings and that this burden should be on the state, because a plaintiff is not in a position, or a practitioner is not in a position, to know what interest the state is seeking to address by a rule and the steps that it took to get there. It's a hard burden on any member of the public, like any person.
But the burden then on the state is the state to anticipate all potential facial challenges?
To the extent that the kuleana of the state agency is to ensure that they have met this underlying obligation, then in a way, yes, because if they do their duty and they're assessing potential impacts, then there should be some assessment of how the rules may or may not create this opportunity for litigants to come out of the woodwork to address it because of the impacts that it has to their rights.
Ms. Aubrey, I understand that, and correct me if I'm wrong, your position is that much like the importance that we put on, say, the Fourth Amendment, mm-hmm. right, against search and seizure, there's an assumption that if there's a search of a house without a warrant, that it is not justified. The government has to mm-hmm. provide justification. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the Fifth Amendment, if it turns out that the government wishes to use a statement by a citizen against the citizen, they have to have a burden to show that it's voluntarily given. But in this case, it seems that you do acknowledge that absent this unique constitutional provision, Article 7, Section 7, the burden would be on the party challenging the rule to show unconstitutionality beyond a reasonable doubt. So this is a change that you're asking that would mean that rather than having to shoulder that burden, the party challenging or the practitioner challenging the rule by just raising the issue would then shift the burden to the government, and the government would have to apply the Kapa'akai analysis. Is that it?
Correct. Yeah, that's the essential part of it. And I would say that, you know, we've characterized this as a burden shift because of the fact that challenges to administrative rules, normally the burden falls on the challenger. But I would also push back to say that, I mean, this is a burden that the state already had. So it, as much as it's a shift, it's also an existing burden. And so I would hope that we don't have to look too far. We don't have to feel like we're stretching the law, because that constitutional obligation has existed since 1978.
When you say that, you mean the Kapa'akai burden is on the state, whether or not we articulate the shifting of the burden in this way? In other words, there's already an obligation on the state. Is that your argument?
Correct. But for the purpose of the question, I know that's how it was framed, and that's because the general rule, right, it would fall on the challenger. So in that sense, yes, it's a shift, but the burden has always existed. That makes any sense.
At this point, we're just across 30 minutes, and I will give you some time for rebuttal. Anything further for the court?
No, that's okay.
All right. Very well. Thank you. Mr. Katowski, your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. The reserve question before the court today is understood and clear, and the questions that this court has already been asking makes it clear to me that there's a good understanding of what the university's position is going to be. Should this burden shift, does the burden of proof shift to the government on a constitutional challenge to an administrative rule? The answer is no. This court's holdings, this court's rulings, its precedent has repeatedly stated that legislative enactments, which are equivocal to rules, are presumptively constitutional. And the burden is on the party challenging the validity of the rule. And the burden is beyond a reasonable doubt. And what hasn't been mentioned here is that if there is a defect in the rule, the third part of the analysis is that it has to be plain, clear, manifest, and unmistakable. That is a very high burden to achieve. Appellants conceded that the burden of proof is on the challenger. However, she's argued, or the appellants argued, that the Article 12, Section 7 changes the calculus and that it shifts the burden to the state. The issue here is Rule 2026, which was promulgated pursuant to Act 132 and HRS Chapter 91. The appellant's argument with regard to the burden of proof here goes against the doctrine of constitutional doubt. And that doctrine states that if a rule or statute can be, if there is two ways of interpreting it, one of which presents constitutional problems and the other which avoids those problems, the preference is that the court pick the latter to avoid the constitutional issues.
Could you help me with that, Mr. Katowski? Assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Article 12, Section 7 wasn't considered when Rule 2026 was passed, how do we take the position that there is a way to find the rule constitutional if an issue has not been considered that should have been considered?
Well, Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, and that goes to a point that Justice McKenna and Justice Edens, I believe, were making in a prior discussion, which is this is, your question involves basically a fact-finding function, fact-finding analysis. And that is something that is not a component, necessarily a component of the rulemaking process. Okay. Yes, there's provisions for testimony and oral and written testimony. Okay. But as Justice Edens pointed out, it is not adversarial in nature. It's not subject to cross-examination. So the record that would be available for a rule is basically what was done to promulgate the rule. In this situation is very unique.
Well, I appreciate your explanation about how important the record is in determining legislative issues. And I did want to get back to my question, though. Is it true that Article 12, Section 7 wasn't considered when this rule was passed?
That is not true.
Okay. And how was it considered?
That would involve going into the facts, which I'm not, you know, I can do that.
I think the position that's being taken by your opposition is that it wasn't considered and that it should be considered. However you want to respond to that, but I mean, that's an important consideration in deciding how to proceed.
I will do that, Your Honor, and I thank you for asking. I mean, can get into the factual background. First of all, I mean, there was an extensive process after Act 132 was passed, and then that resulted in rules being suggested and then consultations with stakeholders in the Native Hawaiian community.
You know, the matters that you're going to get into right now, is that a matter for this particular reserve question?
With due respect, Justice Edens, I would say no. The scope of the reserve question is very limited, but I did want to respond to Justice Wilson's question.
I understand that. Okay. Go ahead.
Is the university's position that it had has an obligation when it promulgates rules to account for Article 12, Section 7? Is that an obligation placed on it, or is that simply you know, it's a provision of law, but it has no special meaning or application when the university considers rules that might implicate traditional and customary.
No, Your Honor, I would say that obligation is incumbent upon all state agencies. It's not something the university disregarded.
Okay. Is it a CHI type analysis that needs to be undertaken? Because otherwise, how would a court know that the analysis was done in a way that was appropriate?
With respect to Kapa'a Kai, I think this court's questions before also pointed out, you know, Kapa'a Kai is a contested case hearing. And so the framework that was set forth in Kapa'a Kai was the result of, you know, it was specifically this court told the LUC that it had to make specific findings of fact and conclusions of law. And so with regards to the Kapa'a Kai analysis, that is different from the rulemaking process. That's separate provisions of Chapter 91. Rulemaking is 91.3.
Why not a statement of reasons that complies with the three elements that Kapa'a Kai identified?
Well,
why should the court not impose that as a reasonable means of implementing the intent and purpose of Article 12, Section 7?
Respectfully, Your Honor, that there is a statement in the rules, and that's in 2026-3F, which Your Honor pointed out earlier is the statement regarding that Native Hawaiian customs and practices would not be abridged.
And how is the court to understand whether that very brief, although sweeping, provision is adequate and reflects an adequate consideration of the rights at stake, the impact of those rights, and that it's the most feasible or it adopts a feasible approach without impact, that minimizes the impact on those rights? How could a court now analyze that once it gets to that stage?
Well, that is part of the development of the facts in the case. The evidence that would come out, like, you know, in the rulemaking process, you know, the university received.
I'm trying to understand your position is that can't take place in this context because there is no rulemaking. I'm sorry, there is no evidentiary record. Why could the university not draft a statement that addresses those three factors that this court identified in Kapa'a Kai? Well,
that part came out, Your Honor, in the public hearings that the university had with regard to promulgating the rules, which are multiple, and that was an obligation of the university to comply with Act 132. Specifically, the university had obligations to which are unusual in rulemaking. There were specific provisions or obligations put on the university under Act 132, one of which was to consult with OHA. Another of which was to have a public meeting, at least one public meeting on the island of Hawaii. The university exceeded those expectations, and it was consulting with OHA since 2011. And it had meetings on Maui, Oahu, and the Big Island twice. There were a total of 8 meetings, not including meetings with the Board of Regents and other open meetings, with all in compliance with Chapter 91. So I'm sorry, Justice Wilson, eventually, I do want to get back to the question. I believe you said, did Article 12, Section 7, did the university consider it? Yes, we did. How is that reflected? It's reflected in the process I just described about all the public hearings. There were testimony received from practitioners, including about what the specific language of Rule 2026 should be, which the university definitely took into account. In fact, it revised some of the drafts based on testimony it received from stakeholders in the Native Hawaiian community.
Okay, I'm working through your explanation. It seems that your position is that because the rules outline a procedure that will protect Native Hawaiian custom and practice, and you're pointing out you followed the procedure, but because it outlines a procedure, then as a matter of law, Article 12, Section 7 has been complied with. Is that correct? Because the converse of that would be that, well, that's the procedure that's laid out, but it may be that this kind of process that takes place in a specific circumstance like this issue, there isn't, with respect to the record, there isn't a sufficient record to show that the procedure was complied with. I don't know in this case, and to a certain extent, I guess our reserve question doesn't include that kind of a record, but I'm just trying to be clear about the burden that you feel the government has, if there's a burden beyond just putting together rules that recognize Native Hawaiian custom and practices?
Well, as I mentioned to Chief Justice Rectum, well, I mean, there is a recognition, there is an importance in Native, that state agencies consider Native Hawaiian rights, and that is something that the university did when it promulgated Rule 2026. And so the deliberations that happened, or the testimony and all the information input that the university received, went into the ultimate final draft of 2026. And with regard to considering Article 12, Chapter 7 rights, I mean, the specific provision 2026-63 provides for special use permits. So whatever language that is being, you know, that people, that the appellant and others may be arguing, saying restricts Native Hawaiian rights, there's a specific provision in the rule that provides for special use permits so that practitioners can exercise their rights free of any fear of impediment.
There was a thought process that went into deciding whether someone who wants to exercise a religious rights has to have a permit to go do that. There were interests that were considered as being very significant that, you know, ordinarily we wouldn't require that of someone who wants to pray. You know, so there's a thought process. Now, it could be a completely valid thought process. You know, why not require a statement of at least to some detail of how those interests were considered and how the university landed on the particular regulatory approach that it came to in this matter?
Again, Chief Justice, I think that was all done in the rulemaking process, and that is what the university had to comply with, which is a statutory scheme of HRS 91.3. And that was the statutory obligations that the university had to fulfill under Act 132 as well.
Mr. Patalsky,
yes.
Mr. The Florist Ohana supposed to know whether they will be sanctioned in some way for conducting traditional practices? I mean, it's pretty restrictive on what is allowed and not allowed. But then this overarching part of the rules say, but they can continue. How do they know what they can and can't do and what time of day they can go in?
Justice Nakayama, I mean, there is a provision for getting, again, it's 2063 or 2026-63, which is special use permits. And that provision specifically provides for somebody who wants to engage in traditional and cultural practices to obtain a special use permit. And that would, in that permit, it would involve the scope and duration of the activity. So it would be specific, it would be exactly, the practitioner would know exactly what they wanted to do, and they would be given permission to do it.
Special use permit can be without an end date. They would ask for certain activities that they'd be allowed to practice, but without constraints of time of day or...
That would be duration and time and scope of activity would be one of the things that would be described in the request for the special use permit. So they would have clarity on what they could do.
And you're going to charge for these permits?
I'm sorry?
You're going to charge people to obtain these permits?
I think there is a minimal fee, Your Honor.
You know, the reserved question relates to burden shifting. And it's my understanding the Flores argument is, you know, we have, and it's based on Article 12, Section 7. There's an affirmative duty. The language in Article 12, Section 7 says that, you know, the state shall protect all rights exercised by cultural practitioners. So why isn't it appropriate for a state agency to bear the burden in these facial challenges?
Your Honor, I think that kind of gets to the heart of the matter, which is the difference between rulemaking and contested case hearings, is that, you know, there's fact finding involved in contested case hearings. There is also, you know, this court's jurisprudence with regards to Native Hawaiian rights are all very fact intensive. They cannot be just, there's no bright line rule that can be applied. If any rule or suggested rule has come from this court, is that the totality of the circumstances have to be considered, and that necessarily involves fact finding.
We also have some opinion stating that we should eschew totality of circumstances when possible. In any event, you know, as Justice Edens has said, our Constitution, with respect to Article 12, Section 7, says shall protect. I see only one other provision in our Constitution that says that, Article 11, Section 6, that regarding coral reefs, and the legislature shall protect people's access to the reefs. I don't see anything. All the criminal statutes say shall enjoy, the defendant shall enjoy. In the United States Constitution, the only provision that says shall protect is Article 4, Section 4, which says that the national government shall protect states against invasion, but nothing with respect to constitutional or individual or fundamental rights. So why shouldn't, as Justice Edens has asked, a different standard apply to a constitutional provision that says that the state has the affirmative burden of protecting that right?
Your Honor, if I understand your question correctly, I mean, you're asking, should the burden shift with regard to...
Right, because we have been, all the discussion has been construing challenges to constitutional provisions that have different language, that doesn't say that the government shall protect. And our Constitution is very unusual in that regard with respect to Article 12, Section 7 and Article 11, Section 6. So why shouldn't the burden shift to the government to show that it did protect those rights to the extent feasible, and that the regulations imposed are reasonable beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, my response to that would be is that Article 12, Section 7 is not absolute. As Justice Edens pointed out, there's the other side of that provision, which says that, you know, this is subject to the state's ability to regulate.
Right.
Right.
So, as I said, why shouldn't it be the state's burden to show that the state did protect to the extent feasible, and that the regulations imposed were reasonable? Because the state does have the right for reasonable regulation.
With regard to rulemaking under Chapter 91.3, that would essentially kind of take over the role of the legislature and add a requirement or provision that is not involved in the rulemaking process.
That's in the Constitution, though.
Correct.
We do have to give effect to the provision if that's what the Constitution requires.
Well, also, other agencies have worked, well, correct me if you interpret this differently, Mr. Katowski, but other agencies have kind of worked with this principle, right? You've got the Waiholi case with the Water Commission. You have the Ka'apakai case that's, I guess, a land use commission. You've got the Kalipi case that I think involved water permits. I mean, this idea that it's necessary to comply with Article 12, Section 7 has kind of been worked through administrative law to some a large extent. So wouldn't this just mean that when the agency is passing rules, and of course we are talking about an important resource, we can all agree this is a resource that does have great cultural meaning, wouldn't it mean that the agency would just know that it needs to, as the CJ says, give an explanation? You said there's a record, a complete record. In this case, you'd have the administrative agency make a statement that, you know, Ka'apakai was complied with, or go through the analysis. And I don't know how long it would even have to be, just a statement.
Your Honor, with respect to the cases you mentioned, again, and this is important to remember, those are all contested case here.
Yes, and this is a jump to a certain extent. You're right. If we go from the idea of requiring a kind of statement by the administrative agency in rulemaking as opposed to a contested case.
Again, with regard to Ka'apakai, that was also a contested case hearing. So, I mean, Ka'apakai was decided by this court in 2000. It is now 2022. So I'm curious as to if the court is inclined to do a burden shift. It hasn't done so in the past 22 years, and certainly it's been had the opportunity to do that. I mean, there are cases like in Pratt and Armitage where Native Hawaiian rights were specifically at issue, and this court did not need to burden shift in order to make an outcome or make a decision in those cases.
Yeah, good point.
Mr. Katowski, you're about 5 minutes over, but I want to give you a chance to wrap up if there's anything further for the court.
Nothing further, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Mr. Dade.
May it please the court. I'm happy that finally there was discussion about the Pratt Armitage and Hanapi line in this case, because I think that the fundamental issue in this case is one of a distinction between how this court has interpreted as applied challenges in litigation or in the case of a criminal defendant asserting a constitutionally protected right, which is a fact-specific analysis, and facial challenges. It is ultimately a distinction that I think could be summarized as a sledgehammer versus a scalpel. The interest of judicial deference is a fundamental one the need to decide issues on a basis no more broadly than necessary. And the way that this has come up in the past is both with the line of cases, which is the Kalipi case, Pele Defense Fund, and PASH. Those principles were then incorporated into the analysis found in Hanapi and Pratt. I think it's worth noting that in an as-applied challenge, and this was an individual who was facing charges of having violated, having done something basically somewhat analogous to the situation that we have here, which was basically he didn't obtain a permit in advance before camping in a state park. Pratt had argued exactly what the plaintiff argues here. And this is from page 20, 210 of Pratt. It says, while the state may regulate even customary and traditional practices, the state has the burden to prove that the regulation is reasonable and allows for the practice of Native Hawaiian rights to the extent feasible. That was what Pratt argued in that case. And that was an argument that was soundly rejected by this court in an as-applied challenge on that basis. And this, the reason being, is that there's an initial burden to show that the action in question is constitutionally protected and followed by a balancing of interests. Balancing of interests is inherently fact-dependent. Reasonableness is inherently based upon a totality of circumstance and the evidence presented. Now, this court or plaintiff is now asking that even though that is the standard at an as-applied level, there's a much more stringent standard that should be applied at a facial level, essentially making it incentivizing striking down laws in lieu of obtaining discrete relief based upon individual facts. That is flipping the understanding of as-applied and facial challenges on its head. Facial challenges, as this court has articulated in the AA versus BB case, incorporating federal precedent, is among the hardest things that can be done in the law, which is basically to establish that under no set of circumstances is a law valid. And that applies even when very important rights are at issue.
Let me ask you this. You're talking about case-dependent balancing under Article 12, Section 7. Facial challenges, it's purely a question of law. There's no facts. Is an administrative rule subject to a facial challenge under the Article 12, Section 7 principles?
I think it is. And I think that the analysis is an Armitage. If it was not subject to a challenge, I think that that would have been said by the decision in that case. But to disagree slightly with counsel for UH in terms of how, what the standard was for determining whether or not it complied. In that case, it was a very similar statute involving a permitting regime, and it involved actions that were taken or a practice that was taken on Kahoʻolawe. The court in that case in Armitage had a very simple analysis. It cites the Kapa'akai. It does, but it doesn't cite it for the central holding. The central holding in Kapa'akai and what makes it novel is the fact that it uses findings of fact and conclusions of law mandated at an agency sitting in a quasi-judicial capacity. And that's very important because one of the things that when we're talking about what is the duty of the state when it's sitting in a quasi-judicial capacity, this court has articulated that it's to make sufficient findings, essentially to show its work based upon the record evidence. Now, when we're looking at that and sort of, you know, showing its work, that's plain vanilla administrative law. Basically, whenever we have findings of fact that are presented, it's just standard basic principles that you start with basic facts and then you build up to the ultimate facts. If you don't have sufficient facts to analyze things, then that's why it gets temporarily remanded as it was in Kapa'akai. But it's important to note that Kapa'akai is not a burden shifting case. It is a case involving specific findings that need to be made and that need to be made and holding individuals to their duty. In those specific administrative proceedings, the individual who bears the burden of proof is not the tribunal sitting as a quasi-judicial capacity. It's the applicant. It's a private individual who seeks to develop land. And the burden is not shifted upon appeal to the state. You look at Kapa'akai, one of the main things that stuck out to me is the principle that a finding of fact, conclusion of law, and decision in order is presumptively valid. That's something that's said there. And basically what needs to happen on appeal is that the individual who's appealing needs to point out the error, but the burden doesn't shift to the state to demonstrate that no error occurred. It's still incumbent upon the appellant based upon normal appellate principles that an error has been made. And so that's not a burden shifting case. The burden that has been articulated is found in the line of cases that was not cited by any party. It's found in Pratt, it's found in Hanapi, and it's found in Armitage. And with respect to the facial challenge that's discussed in Armitage, what we have is consideration of the basic principle that an agency cannot act without considering its effect on Native Hawaiian practices. It did not require findings of fact or conclusions of law. Instead, the analysis looked at the face of the document and determined that there was a permitting regime available at which in the future, rights could be vindicated at a state-specific level. And what we have now is a situation where we have a case where a party decided instead of trying to vindicate individual rights, which is the more, you know, you're dealing with specific facts, you're not speculating about things. Again, this is something, speculation was something that in the Pratt case, you guys have, well, this court said, we can't speculate about all these things, but that's basically what's being asked of agencies now.
Well, may I interrupt you for a moment? You are explaining, I think, the practice with administrative law and challenges that are based on a factual application to a particular individual. And I get you there, but there are certain principles that have been alluded to by the Flores party in this case that are actually constitutional principles that require the courts in all instances as a matter of law to consider that there's a burden on the government. And we went through them, you know, in the sense of the criminal law, right? Whether you're talking about the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure or the right against self-incrimination. So in this case, what's your thought about why that shouldn't take place where you have this very mandatory provision of the Constitution that says that this very important principle, you know, Native Hawaiian custom and practice has to be considered? Why not in that instance just have the burden be clear that it's on the administrative agency when passing the rules to consider this? And in the context of Kapa'akai.
In the context of, did you say Kapa'akai?
Yeah, you know, using that kind of an analysis.
Sure. I think that, well, one of the things that is important is that, and I think the primary reason is ultimately that when, you know, that there's, it's not just a duty to protect. And this is something that's the hallmark of this course, jurisprudence in this area. It's a balance between the duty to protect and preserve traditional and customary rights, along with the state's own right. That's something that doesn't appear in many constitutional provisions either. The state's own right to regulate. And this is why in states, in cases like Pratt, where you had an individual who was actually, you know, seeking to perform traditional and customary rights, the ultimate holding that this court led, or the ultimate holding of this court, is that the individual in question was not utilizing or was not acting reasonably because he did not go through the legally available permitting projects. Well, you know, okay, this kind of flips on the head.
I understand that. And how does that mean that that kind of analysis wouldn't be available in this case, where you've got the administrative agency that says, we have considered in passing this rule X, Y, and Z things?
So I think that what you say is feasible. I'm not saying that it's not something that's within the ability of states to do. The question is, you know, how much do we want to ultimately say, I mean, basically, what is the standard? And I think that the standard in Armitage is basically, is there a process available for the expression of traditional and customary rights at a fact-specific level? And that was why in Armitage, it didn't delve into, you know, a massive record dealing with all the rules relating to Ko'olawe. It just looked at the face of the document and said that there's a permitting regime, and it's evident from the face of the document that it was considered. It's not the same analysis as Kapa'akai. And, you know, clearly, this court, in citing to Kapa'akai in its analysis, if it felt that something more was required, that would have been evident in Armitage.
Why not at the level of when you are formulating the rules, why not require that extra step of an explanation as to how these matters were taken into account and the balance of the state's interest in regulation struck with the, you know, the use and the asserted uses that folks want to make of the mountain?
Yes. And so I think that this is one of the areas, Judge, and so I'm going to answer your question. One of the areas where the specific facts at issue in this case do a disservice to the legal issue, because this is a discrete area of land that specifically relates to, I've been up to Mauna Kea, like I understand the general area. I mean, it's a big area, but it's the most highly scrutinized piece of land in the state. You know, this DLNR, when we're articulating a general principle of law that should be applied with respect to any rules, you know, we have laws, and I'll just single out DLNR's Office of Conservation and Coastal Land Rules. And that's, I believe, chapter 13-5, cited in our brief, that basically has restrictions and regulates conservation land in every single ahupua'a in the state. You know, it's one thing to say when we're dealing with, for instance, the development in Kapa'akai, which is, in, I think it was like 1,000 acres or something like that, right? That's one thing. That's one thing that's feasible. Imagine making a change to the subzones and what that would mean in the OCCL rules, and how would the state go about doing that? Additionally, when we're talking about...
You sort of lost me. I mean, the state, that's what DLNR does, right? So if there's a rule change, they have a hearing, and then they consider the issues under Article 12, Section 7, and that's the way it works. Yes, they have to absolutely do that. I mean, it doesn't matter how big, you know, the conservation district's half the state. So it doesn't matter. At a certain point, if the land mass is really big, it doesn't mean that the agency loses the obligation to comply with Article 12, Section 7.
I think that this is one of the, I think this leads into a question that was asked earlier about, you know, the feasibility of doing this. So I think that, you know, in certain circumstances, so I think there's a few things about this. Yes, there is testimony that is given, and data is allowed to be submitted. But basically, that's a lot of times it's more policy based. Like, I think this is a good idea. I think this is a bad idea. But then, you know, sometimes people raise specific concerns, and then there's a rulemaking process that follows, and then a decision is made. You know, to say that, and to be clear, it is a statutory duty of state agencies to consider the testimony of people who submit testimony. So to the extent that we are going to presume that they didn't, and basically say, if this is the standard that's going to be applied, that presumptively rules are invalid when Chapter 12, Section 7 challenges are made to those rules. Now,
that would be awkward.
Well, I mean, it
that would be awkward. Basically, but that's a little different than saying, you know, you have to apply this particular perspective that is required under the Constitution. Mr. I don't think we have to assume. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Are you finished?
Yeah.
Mr. Day, at the beginning of your last remarks, you talked about applying a rule broadly when you said that you're really looking at one discrete part of the state. Can you continue with that argument, where you're going with that?
With respect to the distinction between rules that apply to a broad area of land? Well, I just think that that emphasizes, because this is something that was brought up before about the nature of findings of fact and conclusions of law and the Kappa Chi analysis. And I think nothing illustrates this better than the 2018 CDUP case. Because, I mean, there's a bunch of cases that plaintiff cites, which are these water cases. And there's a lot of things in the water cases that, you know, that we could talk about why they're distinguishable. But this is one that dealt with the exact piece of land that we were dealing with. When we were looking at what it was and doing the Kappa Chi analysis in that, this court looked at the absence of evidence, within the 30 meter telescope footprint, right? And it did a reasonableness inquiry into specific instances that were in the evidentiary record where Ahu were built for the sole purpose of inhibiting construction. And basically the holding of the court there was that that was unreasonable and basically not a protected activity. I think that when you're dealing with discrete parcels and you're dealing in contested case settings, it's possible to do the analysis that has been set forth. I think when you're dealing with larger parcel, it becomes speculative. I think that much of it is based upon who comes forward with the information. And I think that this plays into the exact reason why facial challenges are disfavored. Facial challenges are disfavored because they're based on speculation. It's because they don't allow the agency to apply it at a fact-specific level. And ultimately, they seek to strike down, legislation or quasi-legislation, which is something that's really a function of the other branches of government. And that's something I would like to add is there's actually very good discussion of this in the Washington State Grange case, which is cited on page 9 of my brief. That's the Washington State Grange case discusses why facial challenges in particular are disfavored as the sledgehammer in favor. Basically, we want to use scalpels instead of sledgehammers whenever possible.
And you would characterize this as a facial challenge. Doesn't it relate to the practices that the Flores case Ohana specifically won't say that are important to them and they want to engage in?
Pardon me, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, is it a facial? Why is it a facial challenge? Don't they argue specific practices that are of import to them that they feel threatened by the rules and are chilled in exercising?
It's
a mix, isn't it?
I think you have to look at the relief that is sought. The relief that is sought is the invalidation of the rule. And that's based, and this is something that had been discussed as a matter of standing, as HRS 91-7. That's what this case is about. It's about striking down the law based on the allegations that provide the standing as an interested person are those essentially saying that you'd like to go in at night. But again, in Armitage, that was the exact circumstance that was analyzed within the context of the state park, the Kaho'olawe rules, was basically individuals who went onto the land without permission and who didn't try to get permission. It's the same issue in this case, or at least similar.
Is it the same issue if they're trying to avoid being put to that test by challenging the validity of the process used to arrive at the rules, or at least seeking a declaration or some statement by the university as to how it arrived at the judgments that it arrived at in terms of nighttime needs a permit, take basalt, need a permit, how you can go about doing creating Ahu?
So I think that this is, again, why the traditional standard And so, again, constitutional provisions apply in different circumstances differently. And, you know, in the facial challenge environment, the question is whether or not there exists circumstances in which a statute or a rule can be applied constitutionally. And so I think that an excellent example of this is the AA versus BB case, which is cited on page. I don't know which page, but it's cited in my brief for basically for the proposition that in Hawaii, to assert a facial challenge, you have to say no set of circumstances. That case involved another very important right, which was the right to custody of an individual's child. And the way, and it would, the statute at issue was one where a de facto guardian who wasn't a legal parent could basically be presumed to have custody. And the way that it was articulated by this court, I believe, was perfect. This court said, while there certainly may be situations where the family court's application of the statute may violate a parent's constitutionally protected liberty interests, we do not conclude that the statute is facially invalid. And the reason is that simply because it can be applied in a way that's not in line with the Constitution doesn't mean that the whole thing gets struck down. And I think that that's what we're dealing with here when we're dealing with a statute where this court has repeatedly upheld the use of permitting regimes when to regulate traditional and customary rights.
Is there any case in which the question of who bears the burden of establishing constitutionality of regulations was clearly addressed under with respect to Article 12, Section 7?
So with respect to a facial challenge?
Right.
Yeah. So the best that we have is the Armitage case. And that was the one case where a facial challenge was addressed by this court. And it was a 5-0 majority that held that the permitting scheme with respect to Ko'olawe was not unconstitutional. And the way the court performed that analysis, again, was not by asking this court, the prosecution in that case to say, hey, why are these rules invalid? What did you do to think about it? All it did was it looked at the specific provision at issue that provided for the exercise of traditional and customary rights through permits. And because of that, the court concluded that it was not facially invalid. That analysis is wholly consistent with the idea that the no set of circumstances applies. In the same vein, the court's rulings on as-applied challenges, where the burden has always rested with the plaintiff, would suggest that to have the burden shift in a facial challenge would be anomalous. And then third, I'll note that in the Armitage case, the court did shift the burden in one of the instances when it looked at the rules, and that was in its discussion of free exercise rights. So basically, there were multiple reasons why in Armitage the court sought to strike down, the defendant in that case sought to strike down the rule. One of them was free exercise. And in doing that, this court mentioned explicitly the Sherbert test, in which it talked about burden shifting in the free exercise context. That was notably absent in the discussion of traditional and customary rights, where the issue before the court in Armitage, as presented and framed by the appellant, was whether or not the rules in question constituted a prior restraint on traditional and customary rights. The issue was squarely before the court.
Mr. Day, anything further? We're about 13 minutes over for the appellees, but anything you want to share with us to wrap up today?
I think that what I'd like to say is that there are multiple ways for individuals who want to assert traditional and customary rights to assert those in a way beyond striking down a rule in its entirety. Rules take time. They're an expression of legislative will or quasi-legislative will. And what we have is other ways that this relief could be found through the exercise of permits or through seeking permits to do, and it could be that they would obtain exactly the relief that they would want, but that hasn't happened in this case. And in other cases, that was held to be unreasonable. Two, through the use of declaratory actions under HRS 91-8, which allows agencies to analyze petitions for declarations based upon specific facts and how they apply to various rules. And finally, of course, there's the as-applied challenge, in court where specific facts are asserted vis-a-vis regulations that are being brought down or used in a specific way. And then I think that from that standpoint, the role of the court is ultimately one to balance. It should not, there's not a valid reason to have it be that presumptively rules that happen to relate to land in the state should be struck down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Day. Ms. Obrey, your rebuttal, and we did. I did give the appellees extra time, so I'll give you extra time as well. So please proceed with your argument.
Thank you. Administrative rules have the same amount of power to destroy cultural practices as a bulldozer. When we think about the difference between rulemaking and the difference between quasi-judicial decision making, we have to think about that rules can have that same kind of effect. Kapa'akai has said that in order for the rights of Native Hawaiians to be meaningfully preserved and protected, they must be enforceable. And to be enforceable and give meaning to this important constitutional provision, there needs to be a consideration of this with administrative rules as well as in court. Kapa'akai reaffirms that the state has a constitutional obligation to affirmatively protect Native Hawaiian rights. And we know that one way to do this, as Kapa'akai directed, is for the agency to show that it fulfilled its duty, show that it's met its burden in written findings and conclusions. And so in the context of a challenge to agency rulemaking, this fundamental constitutional obligation to affirmatively protect these rights should mean that the government bears the burden to show that it fulfilled its duty.
What's your response to Mr. Day's argument that your position is, I guess, inconsistent or in tension with our holdings in Pratt and Armitage, among other cases?
Well, the state, I would say, makes a superficial analogy between the state regulating as a promulgator of rules versus the state regulating when enforcing against practitioners who raise an affirmative defense. These are completely flipped situations. And in these criminal type cases or where someone is being enforced against, the spotlight is on the practitioner and their actions violating an existing rule. And so, of course, they have the burden to prove that they are not breaking the law. And that's true with with affirmative defenses, that the person asserting an affirmative defense has the burden to make that defense. And so in these cases, we're talking about the Native Hawaiian privilege. That is a different procedural posture where we're talking here about the adoption of rules in light of the state's affirmative duties, in light of HRS Section 917 and the any person standard. And in that way is much more akin to an agency decision and like Kapa'akai. So, or even the Carmichael case in terms of requiring findings and putting that burden on the state. So really what we're talking about today is the burden in a legal proceeding to determine where the state violated the law. And so the state should be the one carrying that burden in court to say why or why not that's true.
What about the argument that this is a facial challenge, and if there's any way that the statute, any application of the statute that would be permissible, we should reject the challenge? What's your response to that?
I think my response would be that a practitioner should not have to be fined or arrested in some cases, whether or not that's applicable here, or prohibited from access to the mountain entirely because there is that punitive aspect of the rules, to make a challenge to the rules. I mean, that's the purpose of these facial challenges. There's this 917 challenge. They don't want to get in trouble. They don't want to have to pay fines. And I think declaring a rule invalid, I mean, I think that doesn't mean that there isn't a way to redraft the rules in a way that would make sense without scrapping the entire thing. I mean, I know that they would have to go through the process again, but it's not an unreasonable burden to ask them to do that. And
if I may, what is your relief then? Are you asking for us to invalidate the rules or just to send it back so the proper burden can be applied?
It could be as simple as declaratory relief, but I do think.
Well, what does that look like to you? Declaratory relief. What would be the declaration? That there has to be a burden assumed by the government consistent with Article 12, Section 7, remanded so it can be considered in that framework? Or are you asking for the rules to be invalidated?
The former, that's what we would want in terms of this reserved question. And at trial, that's where we would, you know, delve into the details of the rules and then the relief sought there. When I was thinking about what the university had said in terms of conceding that they had all these hearings and promulgating rules, they consulted with OHA, they received testimony from practitioners, and all of that is incorporated into the rules. That's all the more reason that it is the agency that has the information. The agency knows the steps it took, then they can show their work to show that they were in compliance with Article 12, Section 7, provide the reasoning why these rules do not over-regulate these rights. And that comes down to the reasonableness, and it really is their obligation to do that.
Do you see, in terms of existing law, Mr. Day pointed out in Armitage, we discussed the Sherbert case in terms of religious practices and how that the burden shifts for religious purposes. I noticed that your clients are actually asserting different types of traditional and customary rights, including religious rights, as well as malama'aina, maybe some other rights. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, do you, even under existing law, then, is there a possibility that the burden would apply to the government with respect to the religious aspects of the traditional and customary practices, and whether a different standard might apply to other types of traditional and customary rights?
I think because these traditional and customary rights do have a religious component, as you say, all the more reason that they're fundamental rights that should be treated in the same way. And that so it still answers the question in terms of who bears the burden.
So it is your position would be that everything is embodied within religion to the extent, Mauna Kea is it's a part of the Hawaiian religion.
Correct. It's all connected.
All connected. In
terms of Hawaiian identity and religion. And, mm-hmm. and yeah, it's hard to parse out, I think, the different types. And so as we talk about practicality and we talk about who bears the burden, who's best suited to bear the burden, one of the, it may be a little bit of a minor concept, but there is a burden on a plaintiff to bring an action like this. And to get the information that the university has on hand, there's going to be discovery, there's attorney's fees and costs. So there are issues of judicial efficiency here and access to justice, ensuring that the courtroom doors are open for plaintiffs with valid claims. And I think the court's adoption of even the private attorney general doctrine memorializes the policy of this court that taking the burden off of private citizens to enforce important public rights is very important. And why, just another reason that's a good way to think about the issues that are before you today.
But you are requesting that we formulate a rule that would apply to all Article 12, Section 7 rights, correct? Whether it's Mauna Kea rules or, closed campgrounds or anything.
Correct. Right? Correct. And if it's helpful, want me to repeat it just so that it's an easily understood framework, I'd be happy to say it again, that are, given the state's burden, once a plaintiff asserts that Native Hawaiian rights are impacted by an administrative rule, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that its rules do not unreasonably regulate Native Hawaiian rights. And again, for the reasonability, that's looking to Kapa'akai. So there is that ability to, just draw on all these existing ideas and frameworks that this court is already comfortable with. It's all there. We're not asking for something completely new. It's just a new way to think about the way the law has been framed all these years since this provision has been in place. And And certainly the circuit court would not have brought this question if it was as clear as it's always beyond a reasonable doubt and it's always on the challenger. There's something more here, and I'm happy that this court is willing to consider and to talk this through with us today. So I think when we talk about, you know, the status quo for administrative rules, the challenger is always the one with the burden, but this court has consistently held that the status quo is wrong when Article 12, Section 7 rights are at stake. The Constitution imposes a burden on the state to affirmatively preserve and protect Native Hawaiian rights. And this duty applies no matter what role an agency sits in and no matter what action it takes. And it's going to apply, or it should apply, even when it must defend its own actions in a situation like this. And the intent of Article 12, Section 7 simply cannot be effectuated if agencies are free to regulate TNC practices out of existence, traditional and customary practices out of existence, without a real mechanism for enforcement, which requires the state to justify its actions and show its compliance, whether it's written findings at the rulemaking stage or in the courtroom in a chapter 917 or a section 917 action. We know that legislative history has shown that the constitutional delegates sought the opportunity for this court to provide badly needed judicial guidance and enforcement of Article 12, Section 7. And so that is the opportunity that this court has today, and to declare without hesitation that as a matter of law, policy, and justice, that the government cannot continue putting the burden on Native Hawaiians, and that burden has to remain where the Constitution has placed it, and that is on the state.
Very well. Anything further, Ms. Obi?
No, that would be it.
Thank you to all of our counsel for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement. Thank you.